Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson.
And I'm Ian Morris.
And excuse the slightly different sound quality, but we're recording in person. Ian and I can see our faces.
It's live and terrifying.
It is live and terrifying.
There's a small audience. We're in a glass room.
All my stuff is currently packed up, preparing to move house and build a new studio. But let's start with the news. First up in the news is that Barclays is finally launching its support for Apple Pay in the UK. Now, Ian, you are a Barclays customer.
I am, but I'm a business customer, and business customers don't get Apple Pay.
So what is it about Barclays, then, that has made this such a long time coming?
Oh, well, it's BPay, isn't it? I think it is. I can only assume on their what their feelings are on the subject, but BPay is their own personal e-payment system, but it's not the same. It's a top-up based system, so basically you have to put money on the device and then you can use that to pay for anything that you would with contactless. Yep. But that's not what Apple Pay is. Apple Pay is obviously it comes off your card. It's like any other card transaction, so it's 1,000 times more convenient. And BPay, I'm never going to use it. I've got a dongle. I'm never going to use it. Ever.
I mean, they charge money. I was looking up prices for BPay devices, which is part of their ecosystem. So you can buy a wristband that apparently has no batteries in it. So it's not a smart device by any...
No, it's NFC.
Right.
Basically. It comes with a little SIM card that you slide in. In fact, really, it's the SIM card that does all the thing. These are just... The things that you're looking at are just housings for this sort of card that you get.
And it's 20 quid for that wristband. There's also a fob, which has a large £2 discount.
What else it is. It's a bloody rip-off, mate.
£18 for that. Or you can get a £15 sticker.
A sticker for £15?
Which you can stick to the back. But it does say on this one that you don't have to be a Barclaycard customer to use the sticker.
Don't.
And you can apply this sticker to any device.
You don't have to be a Barclays customer to use any of it, as far as I know, because you're charging it up with your debit card. So it's not like Apple Pay where you're charging against a specific card. This is top-upable. I suppose in theory you could, I don't think this facility exists, but you could go in somewhere with cash and top it up that way. So there are some things about BPay that are interesting, but it shouldn't be considered as an alternative to Apple Pay because it's a completely different product.
Yeah, I mean, you can link it to credit cards and debit cards. I have looked it up, so it's not completely tied into the ecosystem. But obviously this feels like Barclays at least relenting slightly and saying, you know what, people want Apple Pay. Everything's supporting Apple Pay. I mean, I was in a post office yesterday posting, a parcel, and I saw a giant Apple Pay logo in the screen of the post office. And yeah. I associate the post office with old-fashioned stuff. Mm. And it was quite surprising to see that, and I could pay contactless. My brother Andy, who obviously was on the show last week, called me up this morning. He was around last night. He went to the shop to buy something with my card. He kept the card by mistake, called me to say, I have your cards. And I said, well, it doesn't matter because I pay for everything on my phone.
Yeah.
And this isn't an issue. So it is exciting that they're getting involved in this. I think that the not supporting business accounts isn't unique because I think Amex, American Express, business accounts aren't or certainly weren't supported by Apple Pay either.
Yeah,
because I've got an American Express corporate card for my expenses and things at Bloomberg, which isn't supported, but I also have a personal American Express card for my day-to-day credit card stuff that is supported by Apple Pay.
Yeah.
So it's obviously something that is quite difficult to do on the business side of things. Contracts are very different, I think. Probably insurance is significantly affected for things like that.
And I think there are differences in transaction fees as well. The thing is, I think Barclays, ignoring the business side of things, Barclays was stupid not to get on Apple Pay straight away because why would you want your customers thinking about leaving because you're not flexible enough? I think, and people did. People were tweeting, "I'm going. I'm leaving." And to leave your bank account is actually a fairly major and tedious operation.
I've had the same bank account for over 2 decades.
Yeah, same with me.
It's tedious, as you said.
Although that said, it is supposed to be easy. You're supposed to be able to do it automatically now, including move all of your direct debits over. Mm. So it shouldn't be tedious. but I haven't got the guts to test it.
Well, I'm just at the ball aching stage of completing a purchase on a house. So right now, anything to do with money, bank, solicitors, I've had enough of them. So I'm not about to start jumping ship bank wise. But let us know if you are. Are you excited to use Apple Pay on your Barclays account? Let us know your experience. Did it change your life? Podcast@natelangson.com. Well, I'm calling this next section hashtag beast news because dog microchipping is becoming compulsory across the United Kingdom. This is something that has been compulsory in a number of countries before. I did a bit of background research on this one. Apparently, it is already compulsory in New South Wales, in Australia. New Zealand, it seems that dogs registered, which I assume is a more formal term for born and recorded, after 2006 have to be microchipped, and in Israel as well, all dogs, it seems, have to be microchipped. The interesting thing to side to this, A, this is dogs, we're not talking about cats, which may be large and prone to running off without their owners anyway, and it also doesn't apply to another group of regularly chipped beasts, which we'll come to in a few moments. But it's an interesting thing to say you have to do this by law, because it's not always free. I looked at Pets at Home, which was at least top of the Google machine when I searched for cost for microchipping. Charges about £10, £15 to have, you know, per beast.
It's a relatively low cost in terms of what a dog is going to cost you, or a cat, though. Yes. I mean, like, food is expensive for dogs and cats, isn't it?
It depends. I mean, you can feed a dog pretty much anything, can't
you? Well, that is true, yeah.
But I see what your point. But it's interesting that this is going to be, you know, law. I mean, you're facing a £500 fine if you have a dog, it goes missing, the authorities find it, it isn't chipped.
How are they going to know whose it is, though?
Well, that was going to be my point, is if it's not chipped, that's part of the problem. Yeah, you know, this is to help dogs. There are 100,000 strays apparently logged every year in the UK, which is a lot. You know, if you put all those in a boat, that's a heavy boat.
Yeah.
It's a big problem.
I'm well over the spec set down by Noah.
Yeah.
He only wanted two.
He did. Well, that's what happened.
One of each flavour.
Yeah, well, they've been breeding, haven't they, since then? But you are facing £500 fine, and the chances are, if you have lost your dog and you have children crying asking you to find it, and the authorities have found it, you will meet the authorities and they'll hand you your beast with a bill.
They're probably not going to fine you £500 in reality, but I take the point.
It's a deterrent.
It is a deterrent. But I mean, really, I think what probably should happen is that maybe if they're going to make this sort of thing the law, then why not make it so that the breeders, if you get a bred dog, have to put the chip in. And if you've got a rescue dog, it's going to be chipped anyway.
Yes.
I think really the problem, it won't be around for very long in terms of cost. Mm. And did you know that they're also DNAing dog poo and dogs in a park? They did a trial in a park in Barking, of course.
Brilliant.
Where else did they do it? And the idea was that they would, in order to go in the park with your dog, the dog had to have a cheek swab. Mm. And then if the dog did a poo and they found the poo, then they would
mail at you.
Yeah, that's a pretty good idea. Then they would basically fine you.
Wow.
That's on the BBC News.
That's amazing. I didn't realise that. But yeah. It makes a lot of sense because it's a big problem. And a lot of this is to do with, you know, keeping costs down for councils.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a lot. Apparently, there are 1 million dogs alive in just the UK which have not been chipped.
Each of those doing 1 million poos a day.
Well, whether they're chipped or not tends not to affect their bowel movements. but it's 1 in 8 dogs that aren't chipped. So 1 in 8 dogs that go missing have the potential to not be logged, which means somebody has to spend time, you know, logging that, rehoming them.
Yeah, so I think after a dog.
It's a good thing, but it wouldn't surprise me if this ultimately comes into effect cats, because cats tend not to spend all their time with their owners a lot of the time, and so it wouldn't surprise me if that comes down
the
line.
True, but cats are a lot more able to look after themselves. So if a cat goes missing, the chances are it's off doing something, right? Yeah. I mean, okay, sometimes they get kidnapped. Were catnapped. I think cats are less of a problem, but also you know, like with a dog, they have a potential to cause a lot more nuisance, and they're a lot more, I would say they're more dangerous. I mean, obviously, of course, most dogs aren't, but you're much more likely to be approached and bitten by a dog than you are a cat. A cat is like a snake. It wants to be as far away from people it doesn't know as possible.
Never heard of a cat described as being basically like a snake.
Well, there is a ferret, which is a cat snake.
Interesting. Well, speaking of alternate beasts, which of course was the first game ever released.
You were the one that started this beast thing, by the way, I'd like to point out.
I wanted to do a little true or false quiz before we move on to the next topic, because in my research about chipping and dog chipping and things, I found out a number of other breeds that are often chipped, not necessarily in the UK, but around the world. So I'm going to do a little true or false with you here.
Okay.
See if you can guess correctly. They're not all true and they're not all false. Which of the following beasts are often chipped? Parrots.
I would say yes, they're very valuable and live for a long time.
True. Horses.
I would say yes, they're very valuable and live for a relatively long time.
Also true. The spiny lump sucker.
I don't know what one of those is. I'm going to say no.
It's kind of a fish sort of thing.
Oh, well then, I mean, they're probably worth a fortune, right? So probably yes.
False. The spiny lump sucker is not commonly chipped.
Okay, fine.
The llama.
The llama. Well, again, it's big. If it got out, you'd have problems. Yeah, I'm going to go yeah.
True. The giant African land snail. Considered a pest in Florida and many parts of the world.
Quickly, give Kate a call. I'm going to go with no.
No, giant snai are not commonly chipped. Mostly because if you lose one...
he has not got very far.
Even if you lose it when you're on holiday, it's going to struggle.
A week later, it'll just be...
just down the
over
drain.
There.
Yes.
Where's the snail? Oh, it's there.
Exactly.
It's not that wall.
The goat.
No.
Yes. Is chipped.
It is chipped?
Often chipped.
Because they're always up trees, aren't they?
If you say so. The micro pig.
Oh, but they're very valuable, aren't they, micro pigs?
Yep.
Also, they don't exist. There's no such thing as a micro pig.
Well, there sort of is.
Well, there kind of is. But yeah. They do tend to become non-micro pigs.
The penguin.
Well, yes, because they track them, don't they?
They do indeed. They are commonly chipped for that exact reason. The muskox.
No.
No, they are not commonly chipped.
Okay,
the prairie dog.
No.
They are.
They are?
They are.
Well, they are a pest, aren't they, in America? They're quite dangerous.
Yep. And finally, the elephant.
Oh, yeah, you've got to chip your elephant.
Absolutely. You have indeed. And yes, elephants are commonly chipped. So that's the which beast is chipped, true or false,
guide to
special.
Beast chipping.
But the reason that I found this interesting is because really in the future, we're probably going to get to the point where most animals are chipped to some extent because there's a lot of medical information that can be kept on animals. Yeah. As you say, some are very valuable. Some are possibly rare, extinct or nearing extinction. They want to be tracked by GPS. You know, if you have a particularly heavy pocket full of cash and love your animals and want to track them while you're away, chipping is getting common. But anyway, if you have a dog, you have to chip it now or you're facing a £500 fine, and that's just not fun for anybody.
The internet of beasts.
Well, last up in the news section, before we get to talking a bit about some gadget action that's been exciting us this week, I wanted to mention something that John Lewis is doing here in London. In fact, just around the corner from where we are right now, in fact, it's going to be installing a smart home section in its Oxford Street store, which is its flagship store here. It's a big department store, for anyone listening outside of the UK. John Lewis, very, very large department store, sells everything from gadgets to furniture to light bulbs to upholstery to all sorts, food as well. And it's going to have 1,000 square foot space, which actually opened this week. And it wants to, and this is a quote from the IT director there, Paul Coby, on v3.co.uk this week, demystify the concept of the smart home. Now, it says that it's had an 81% increase of sales in smart home products just in the last 12 months. And it wants to try and show people what can be done with these devices. So it's got four zones: kitchen, entertainment, sleep, and home monitoring. Samsung's smart fridge, that's the one we talked about earlier in the year from MWC, I think, that's got cameras inside it so you can see how much cheese you've got left, eggs, perhaps, whatever's your poison.
Lettuce.
Indeed. It's also got
sleep
tracking system. You never want to keep a snail in a fridge.
No. Lettuce for the snail, not the snail. You keep your tortoise in the fridge, mate, not the...
Fair enough. We've taught us all something this week. Also, it's got an oven that lets you put dinner on before you leave the office. Nest, of course, is in there.
Yeah, broken nest.
A bunch of stuff in cameras. This is neat, right? I mean, it's important, I think, for these kind of devices to get in the faces of the general shopper. The key thing for me, and I want to test this, and I will be testing this, is how knowledgeable are the staff when it comes to these sorts of devices? Because if I take the mental image of average Joe, And he walks into, it could be a woman, Josephine.
Well, Joe is a unisex name, so.
Exactly. Walks into the shop and says, why do I want a camera in my fridge? Why do I want to put cameras in my home and have it monitored? Is that not a security risk?
Of course it is. It's a massive security risk.
But I want to know how that is communicated to the consumer.
Well, they say, yes, it's a massive security risk. Criminals will be able to see inside your fridge. And everyone will go, oh, actually, I don't care about that too much.
No.
It's okay if they see it inside my fridge. I tell you one thing I've encountered. I mean, I'm a bit worried about the Internet of Things. I'm particularly worried about cloud monitoring security systems because I tested Canary. Have you tested Canary?
No, but I saw an advert on the Tube for it just this morning and thought they've done well.
Well, they might have done well, but I don't like it at all because it's one of these things where you're basically held hostage with these things. And and cloud services in general have the potential to do this because you are essentially going to have to pay a monthly fee. And this is probably true of a lot of these products that they're selling here. You know, like, do you have to pay a monthly fee to look inside your fridge? And I think that, you know, like, it's okay if there's one service that gives you monitoring of your whole home. So say maybe a hub, which you then pay a subscription for. Mm. But when you're talking about each individual thing, and Canary's a real pain because you only get access to the footage for 24 hours if you don't pay. But also, all that footage automatically gets stored on their cloud, and you don't get any choice in that. And as far as I know, I don't know how you would go about it, but you can't delete that footage. You have no control over what happens to your home security video when it reaches their servers.
Well, we should probably come back and talk about Canary in a future episode.
Or any service like that.
But specifically, it's these sorts of issues that I think, you know, they're making a big deal about this in John Lewis, making a big space for it. I'm going to be very curious to know how many of these issues are being address. I mean, if the devices do their jobs properly, and if the manufacturers are communicating the sorts of security prerequisites, if you like, that you need to keep in mind, then great. But being in a high street store, there is a huge opportunity to either increase the fear, uncertainty, and doubt, or gloss over it in order to make a sale. I mean, yes, that's true online, but when you're in a shop, you go in for a reason. One, to see the products in person and feel them, and another is to get advice. And I think for something like smart home and opening up your house to the internet, that's something we need to be careful of. But I think overall, this is good. It's open now, and I'd welcome anyone who ran to go and, not necessarily go and buy something, but go in and grill the staff, see what kind of advice you get.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, we should definitely do a special about the Internet of Things because so much of stuff gets, you know, has happened. Like, for example, Google's just shut down they bought a company that has a home monitoring hub, and they've shut it down. So people who bought that hub now can't use it. I mean, not can't use it in some ways. Literally, it is a brick.
Yes.
And, you know, again, back to that whole thing. But we should definitely talk about that in some more detail.
Well, let us know your thoughts on this. podcast@natelankson.com. Welcoming any thoughts you have, experiences you've had with great customer service on Internet of Things stuff in other stores. Very much welcoming that. I want to just get onto a couple of emails we've had come in over the last few weeks. We've got more than we've got time to get to this week, so we'll come back to this next week. One comes in here from Nino, who says, hi, further to the podcast episode on 3rd of April, perhaps you can consider the following in relation to the review of the iPad Pro. It might just be a really bad idea to consider tablets as laptop or desktop replacements. Around me, most colleagues use Surface Pros. We're in Microsoft consultancy house, and we all have DisplayLink docks with one or more screens linked to them, plus keyboard and mouse, one USB cord, one power cord, and you're a desktop user with an extra 12-inch screen on the side. When the Surface Pro users are away, they have the Surface keyboard and tend to carry external mice, plus a dongle for connecting a screen. Some of them take full-size Logitech keyboards and USB hubs. It's a bit of a faff, in my opinion, he says. If instead they use iPads, they would be stuck outside of the USB and multiple screen ecosystem. Is the iPad ecosystem worth that hassle and expense? I think I'll vote for a proper SSD-equipped 15-inch laptop and maybe an 8-inch tablet for note-keeping, and hey, have a look at this, document duties as the right combo. Now, I think that's a really good point.
All right.
And basically, that kind of ties into the idea of saying, and we said this, I think, last week about the Surface Book, is that it's not a tablet replacement, it's a laptop. It's a powerful laptop as well. But, I mean, there are some situations where with the iPad, you can use things like AirPlay to hook up to televisions, again, if you have a receiver for that sort of thing. You can actually use, and I've done this with a couple of different apps, you can use the iPad as a second screen for a PC or Mac.
Yeah, you can, and I've done the same.
Either tethering it with a cable and you get better latency, or purely wirelessly over a wireless network, which is great for things like IM or anything that doesn't need a really fast refresh rate. But it's a great email, and definitely a good example of how tablets can be used more as PCs rather than as just notepad type devices. One other thing, email we got as well, this from Tony, says, thanks for the in-depth review of the small iPad Pro. I went to the site to look to order today, noticed a small but significant niggle. Smart keyboard for iPad Pro is only available with a US keyboard layout. Not sure if anyone else mentioned this. Thanks for all the good work. That's from Toby. I looked this up too. It does not have a UK or in fact any non-US keyboard layout for the smart keyboard on the iPad Pro.
But what's the difference between the keyboard that you've got on your Mac?
Well, for example, if you want to type in, say, the pound symbol, and I mean the proper pound symbol, the one that's an actual pound, not a hashtag, on the US keyboards, that's above the three if you use Shift. Yeah. Whereas on UK British keyboards, you have the pound symbol. You also have the euro symbol on some keyboards. You also, on non-Apple devices, have the double quote mark over the two instead of next to the shift key, which Apple does and the US does, I think, in the US. So there are a few of these examples. It's worse in other countries where they have... you know, different character sets, for example, or different layouts. I think France and Germany have different layouts as well. But at the moment, you are stuck to only using the British English one. I think in a lot of software, you can tweak this so that at least if you press the key that you're used to pressing for a particular key, you can use it. But
I don't find it a massive problem, you know. And I mean, I totally respect the position of people who obviously, you know, might need those features. But I haven't struggled with that. So,
I've not struggled either, but it's just a bit annoying. It's one of these things where you do global launches, but...
Yeah, but that's Apple, though, because they don't really... I mean, they do it better on a laptop. But they still don't do it completely right. You're still not going to get that at key in the right place, are you?
No, but that's an Apple thing, you're right. I mean, you can buy British English and other keyboards for the Mac, and they actually work fine with the iPads or iPhones. They work over Bluetooth. I've done it. It's a good way of carrying it around.
Or you can get a Logitech one of these.
You can get a Logitech keyboard as well, and they do British English. So yeah, good point. Thank you, Toby. Any other points people have? podcast@natelangson.com. That is where Nino and Toby wrote in this week. We've also got others. The curious one coming next week, perhaps, in response to our request for hate mail. But we'll come back to that in 1 week. Let's quickly check in with Tom Merritt over at DTNS about what's been exciting him in the tech world this week.
Hey, thanks, Nate. This Monday on DTNS, industry vet Travis Falstad will try to explain to host Allison Sheridan what VR is good for beyond gaming. This past week, we discussed why Apple Pay is slow catching on. And in fact, our Australian episode today with Peter Wells talks about that from the perspective down under. We also kick around why Twitter is paying to stream U.S. gridiron football, Facebook's clone of Periscope live streaming service, why big tech companies are splitting themselves up into smaller bits, and the Brave browser's Brave plan to hijack ads for your benefit. Might even pay you for it. All of that and more at dailytechnewsshow.com.
Well, last up today, certainly not least, we're going to talk about the Huawei P9. This is Huawei's new flagship phone. So two variants of this phone. There was a launch this week. Ian wrote a very amusing launch roundup, which if you go to Forbes or do Google Ian Morris Forbes and find his piece, very interesting.
It's called Huawei Owes Me One Afternoon.
Yes, very worthwhile little read about that. But we're going to focus on the product today. Ian, you've got it in your hands.
I do, yes.
I've not held it, so I'm going to take it off
can
you.
Have a hold. It is quite interesting, this product. It may not be as interesting as they suggested it is. But it is definitely a device worth investigating. So, like the LG G5, there are two cameras on the back. Huawei has approached it in a slightly different manner. One of these is apparently a black and white sensor, and one of them is a colour sensor. Now, I don't understand how that works, because, as far as I'm aware, is it even possible to make a black and white sensor? I mean, that's not how these chips work on the whole, is it?
Design it to do whatever
you could. I don't know the details. I guess maybe that's what they've done.
You can do it. I mean, it's monochrome as opposed to RGB.
Yeah.
As opposed to, infrared.
I wonder if it's the software filtering it. Was sort of what I was driving at, more than the fact that, I guess it's possible. You can test it. If you take a photo with this camera in black and white mode, you will notice that one of the sensors works. And if you take it with a colour image, you'll notice the other one works. So you can do that by putting your finger over it. Mm. But it's quite clever. And obviously, Huawei, having two sensors means you do have other options. You can do depth mapping, and there are lots of reasons that having two sensors on a camera is worthwhile, and one of the reasons that I think Apple may be looking into this. Huawei pictures this camera as having like the shallow depth of field mode. I've tested it, and my finding, and I was talking to your brother about this at the launch actually, was that in fact it's doing what all camera phones do, and it's a software solution for defocusing backgrounds. I took a picture, and at the edge of the fine detail, I could see some blurring, which indicates to me that what's happening is that the phone is not able to do shallow depth of field because it doesn't have an iris. So instead, what they're doing is they're just software blurring it.
On the inside, this is interesting because it doesn't. It's not
very
a Snapdragon.
It's not Dragon. No,
it's got
a Snapdragon.
It's called a Kirin, which yes. It's an octa-core, so 8-core processor. It's ARM-based, obviously. It's got quite a lot of internal memory if you want it.
Yeah, but you can have up to 4 gig, right? Or 4 gig of RAM or 3 gig of RAM.
Yeah.
Or you can have, and storage, you can have 32 and 64, is that right?
That's right. It's also got Android 6,
yep.
What's that called?
Marshmallow.
Is it Marshmallow?
Yeah.
Okay, it's got an 8-megapixel front-facing camera. It uses USB-C, which
it
I think
does.
Is a nice idea.
Well, who cares, really?
Well, fair enough.
Doesn't bother me in the slightest.
And it's going to cost about £500, so it's priced.
It's expensive.
It's priced high end.
Yeah.
For a brand that you know, LG has done very well in this field. Obviously, Samsung's done extremely well in getting their brand out, but Huawei is still not a known brand here, and I do wonder if they'll struggle. But I think what they've done well. I mean, the design is lovely. It feels premium. It actually reminds me a little bit of Sony's design philosophy.
It's very square, isn't it? Although it's a rectangle, but
yeah.
It is very. There is something about it. You're right. And when you say Sony, actually, that is a very accurate way of describing it.
So it's sort of, if you like the general design philosophy of the iPhone or the Samsungs, but you also like what Sony does, and you're looking for something that, I mean, having the Leica, the name there, I mean, the proof is going to be in the pudding. And I've just done some testing with the camera. It focuses very, very close. It's very good if you're doing shots of very small products. Or
I'll send you some. We'll put them on the blog if you want when the podcast goes up.
Let's do that on natelangston.com/podcast. And we'll do that. But I mean, my first impressions seem to be very, very good. And,
yeah.
And again, this is only something we're going to see other manufacturers jumping onto the dual lens idea.
And you can have, the problem with it is it is slightly confusing in that there are a lot of models. So although there's a plus sized one and a regular sized one.
Yeah, the P9 is 5.2 inch. That's what you've got,
yep.
Which is an IPS LCD display with a 1080p resolution. Then there's a larger one, 5.5 inch, which has AMOLED, which is the Super AMOLED, which is the same as the Galaxy S7. Still 1080p resolution, but slightly larger, so the pixel density won't be quite as high, but it's probably barely noticeable looking at it.
It still beats the iPhone, and you can't tell on the iPhone, can you?
You can't, and I would say, well, you can if you get very close.
Yeah,
up.
But you have to be really close.
But it does. The larger one does have a 400 extra milliamp-hour battery, which is possibly quite useful
huge,
there.
Huge deal, that.
Yeah.
Did I mention that you can get it in dual SIM? You can get it in dual SIM. Probably not in the UK, but there is also a micro SD card if you're in one of the regions that doesn't have dual SIM.
That's
so
very
you
neat.
Choose. It's kind of been done before that, but yeah, it's a good way of doing it.
Well, Ian is going to send some sample photos. We'll put those on the blog at natelangston.com/podcast.
We'll take some of our lunch, shall we?
Yes, we'll take some out on our lunch walk. Maybe of Ian's hair, which looks a bit like an explosion.
It does look like an explosion.
Right now.
Sort of explosion of
partway through.
Follicles.
Indeed. But in the meantime, if you have any questions about the P9, podcast@natelangston.com is where to send them, or send them to Ian at IanMorris78 on Twitter. He's got one. I haven't at the moment, so he's best for that. And we'll answer those next
week.
I'm
sure Huawei would like me to give it to you because I've probably annoyed them.
Well, we'll see. But we'll check back in with that next week if you have questions. And thanks to everyone who's keeping the reviews coming on iTunes around the world. Massively appreciate that, as ever. That is how we would love to receive your payments, your thanks, your compliments, whatever that is. It's in the form of a review, and it's in the form of telling a colleague or a friend and helping them install the podcast on their devices. We'll be back next week, hopefully in the studio, but we'll play that by ear. I will be moving house, and I am technically going to be homeless for 2 weeks until I move into my new house. So there may be a slight gap in programming over the next 2 to 3 weeks, but we'll try and keep it to a minimum. But until then, speak to you later.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.